Subscribe to our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. No medical exam or health questions will be asked. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand.
Sportsnet Magazine live for Ben Ennis. I'm Roger Lajoie hosting this morning. John Gregg and Rory Boylan with me. It is the weekend. It's hot. It's sticky. It's the middle of August. And it feels like October. It feels like October, boys.
Yes, it does.
It's a strange feeling.
It is a strange feeling. Friday night, the Rogers Center is electric. David Price is pitching for Toronto. We've seen him pitch here before, but he's pitching for Toronto. John, this city is gripped like it hasn't been in decades.
I don't think it's been gripped like this for any sport in decades, right? I mean, you can compare it to the Raptors maybe the past couple of years, but, you know, there hasn't been anything this exciting in a long time. Obviously, the Leafs haven't been doing it, and TFC hasn't been doing it, and everybody's got Jays fever. I was watching a frigging Cleveland Indians game the other night because I'm so excited about the Jays, and I'm like the biggest cynic in the room. I don't usually get excited about this. I'm a Toronto sports fan waiting for the sky to fall, and it doesn't feel to me like it's going to fall anytime soon.
Yeah, I mean, even those Raptors, how good they were. There were really, really, really strong teams in front of them that, okay, if the Raptors make the playoffs, it'd be nice to win a round or two. But you never really thought this team has the chance to take home the title. But you look at these Blue Jays, and they got to be one of the top two or three teams in the league. They have one of the top aces in the game. They got a murderer's row in the order there. They just and their bullpen's coming on now, finally. So they kind of seem to have everything going. Lots of time to go. In this season still, there might be a bumpy road still ahead, but when you look at this lineup up and down, I mean, they have pretty good depth, they have high-end talent, and they look like they have a real shot to win it all.
Yeah, I mean, when was the last time you were excited to watch the Blue Jays with a one-run lead in the seventh, eighth, and ninth innings? Like, it's been, you got to go back to Henke and Ward and those guys, and it seems now like they've got that figured out, and that along with figuring out the defense has been as big a push for this team as anything, I think. Obviously, David Price is there, but the defense and the bullpen, I mean, that has turned them into real contenders.
You turn the calendar back to July 29th, day before the deadline. The team is kind of, you know, limping around a little bit. There's some concerns. They're 7-8 games back. It's not looking so great. And you, John, addressed, you know, some of the things we were worried about this team. And Rory, you were mentioning it as well. But here's the end of the day. So what was the problem? Needed an ace at the top of the stud. The bullpen was not deep enough. Outfield defense, maybe not quite as good. Infield depth, whatever. You take a look at it, tick, 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 tick. Every element was addressed by Alex Anthopoulos. And regardless how this plays itself out by the end of October, actually early November this year for the World Series, you've got to give Alex Anthopoulos a credit because you talk about addressing every need. Where is the weakness on this team?
Right, you're right, Roger. I mean, I was on this show a couple of months back now, and I was lamenting the fact that what they didn't have was that stopper at the top of the rotation, the guy who you can pretty much count on every 5 days to go out and get you a win and put an end to any kind of misery. Obviously, Alex took care of that. And for me, I mean, the weakness on this team, if there is one, it's things like arm strength in the corner outfield positions. You know, it's not, there's, and that's nitpicking because otherwise, you know, assuming that Marco Estrada stays the way or keeps pitching the way he has been for the most of the season, the rotation is pretty strong. And obviously the batting is ridiculous. So for me, there's not much of a weakness. You got to really nitpick to find anything.
And you talk about needing that ace at the top before they picked up David Price. All right, Dickey has been awesome these last 2 months or so. And his numbers almost fill that role on his own right now. And then you have David Price coming in and pitching what he's doing. Estrada's had a much better season than I think anybody would have expected. And then you have Burley, who's just this guy who goes out and gives you a lot of innings that you don't have to maybe go to the bullpen so early with a guy like that. He's fairly consistent. You know what you're going to get from Mark Burley every time. And there are your four pitchers. When you only really need three, maybe a spot start from a fourth in the playoffs when you get that far. And now we might face a situation where you kind of have a good problem to have when Marcus Stroman comes back. And what the heck do you do with this guy? And all of a sudden you have so many pitchers to pick from here. And what do you do with Drew Hutchison going down?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, Dickey, the counting stats for him since the All-Star break, he's like 4-0 with a sub 1.5 ERA. I mean, he's been performing like the guy he was thought to be when they first traded for him, right? I mean, he's stepped up and he's an ace. And now they have two. And then you have Burley pitching well, of course. And if you got three guys who can go out there and you can pretty much guarantee seven innings and a win, I mean, that's something we haven't seen in this city in a long time.
Well, and what it really does, guys, it's one thing to have a Price, which is fantastic, and all the depth and everything we talked about, and Tulo is his best shortstop in baseball, perhaps. That's all positive. But I look at it, and it's funny. I'm one of the official scorers of the Jays, and I'm doing the game the other day, and I'm sitting there, and I'm just watching it, like paying close attention. And I imagine if I'm a player sitting in the dugout, I'm sitting there, I'm feeling pretty good because I'm looking at that lineup. I'm going, you know what? Somebody's going to hit a home run, which really, really, though, takes the pressure off. Because you guys talk about the big story is, oh, they brought in Tulo and Price. No question. But David Price, until Friday night, had only pitched twice, and the team was on an 11-game win streak. It's everybody else is picked up because now the pressure's off. So now a Dickey, a Burley, and Estrada in particular, a younger guy, the guys at the bottom, you think Ryan Goins is nervous about getting a hit with that lineup in front of him?
Goins gone? What do you mean?
He has four homers now. he's the new Barry Bonds, I guess. Not steroids, home runs. But when you do look at it, guys, it lifts everybody. Like Price makes Dickey, Burley better. He makes Estrada better. He makes everybody else better. And it's not something... a kind of an opinion you usually hear a lot with baseball, which is such an individual sport. But I really do believe when the guy, David Price, walks in your locker room, I think that makes you better.
Oh, for sure. I think so. And I think, and I think Dickey was kind of like that too when he first came, being a Cy Young winner. When you add guys like that, it's such a pick-me-up, not only for the locker room, but the fans too. It's such a different atmosphere when you go down to Rogers Center now. And you could tell that the players are kind of getting blown away by it. Even the Yankees were speaking about how much of a playoff atmosphere it was in Toronto. Like, whoa, this is serious right now. And we haven't seen this in 22 years. And it's another level of that. Yeah, the players have this support now, and they're into it, and they're very pumped up about it. And now you have the fans coming in early mid August, and they're like this. What is it going to be like in September?
Yeah, and you're right, Raj. You get past, you look at the Yankees, you get past the first maybe four batters, and you're not afraid of them anymore. Whereas this Jays team, it's up and down the lineup. And it also seems like when a Tulowitzki or a Donaldson has an offer at the top of the order, you see guys like Goins or Pillar going, you know, 3-for-4 with two RBIs at the bottom of the order. They're just, everybody is picking up everybody on this team. And they're all also, something I think is important, is they're also all able to get rest. So you're not counting on these guys to be the stars every night. You're giving them days off. You're not worried. Encarnacion goes down for the better part of a week. Ho-hum. You know, we've got other guys. And, oh, by the way, we got better defense at first base without him anyway. So, and other guys need their at-bats. I mean, it's just, the depth is amazing on this team right now.
Rory Boylan, John Gregg, Roger Lajoie with you. Sportsnet Magazine live this weekend, and great to be with you here on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Perfect illustration of that, we get into Goins again, is the game against Oakland. Tulo, Martin, Edwin out of the lineup. That's when Goins hits his three-run homer. That's what I mean, like you're sitting there, somebody's going to do it. And if it's not him, it'll be Pillar. Or it'll be, how about Colabella? You look at any team that wins a championship. I'm not saying this team's going to win the championship, but if they do win the championship, all championship teams usually have that one guy that just comes out of nowhere, and becomes a 330 hitter with great power at 31 after most of his career in the minors. And then you have Smokey, who comes in. So Edwin's not in the lineup. So that's the thing with this team, their confidence level is so high. And as far as being afraid of them, all due respect to the Yankees, who still have some great... If it was 2010, I might be afraid of that lineup. That's the problem with them. And we had role reversal at the trade deadline. The Yankees, well, we tried, but we couldn't, and we had to watch, because we're spending so much money, and the Blue Jays acted like the Yankees did, and the Yankees acted like the Blue Jays did. I mean, wow.
Yep, and I think, you could bring in Pillar into that conversation too, Roger. I mean, he was slated to be the fourth outfielder at the beginning of the year, and where would you be without him, both in the field and especially earlier in the season at the plate? I mean, he has stood up big time for this team this year, and you know, proved himself to be, you know, not an elite center fielder by any means, but a better than serviceable one, and just the kind of guy you need to kind of play plug and play with in this lineup.
And Justin Smoak has been awesome for these guys. I mean, just the defense alone has been really impressive, but he's been pretty good with the bat too, filling in when Edwin's been down playing, or when he's just been playing first base. I mean, that guy's been tremendous. And then Colabella, like you mentioned, I mean, it's just coming from everywhere right now. And then you consider they had Michael Saunders, who went down in
who?
Yeah, exactly. I mean,
don't even think about him. You're right.
You don't anymore. And I mean, if they had this guy here as well, I mean, there are so many options on this team. And the series that they had just swept in New York, how often do we see that from the Blue Jays? I think every run except for one came off of a home run. I mean, that's a scary lineup right there.
I was in Boston last weekend, and Red Sox fans were cheering the Blue Jays. And not just because they were beating the Yankees, but I saw Kevin Pillar highlight compilations on local television or sports television. I was in a bar, and they were cheering that amazing catch he made on the Thursday or Friday night. I mean, this team has hit, you know, national consciousness when it comes to MLB. And it's not like we're only excited here in Toronto or in Canada with this team. People are excited all around baseball for the first time in, you know, since 1993 about the Blue Jays. And it's great to see.
Well, Las Vegas now picks the Blue Jays as a World Series favorite. And when you think about a team that has not been in the playoffs in 22 years, and at the time that the odds changed, the Blue Jays weren't even in first place yet. That shows you the respect, not just from the bettors, but as you mentioned, John, American media with this team. I think one of the separators with the team is, and I it's pretty much impossible to argue. Mike Woolner and I were talking about this the other day on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. You look at this team, and I don't want to compare them to 92, 93, because it's, first of all, it's irrelevant, and second, it's 2015. But one thing that really, I think, is a separator, not just for this team and why we're waxing poetic and we think they're so good. Tulo, Donaldson, Bautista, Edwin, and Martin. I'm going to stop there. Never mind everyone stop. Those five guys, all right? Those five guys. You could make an argument that any one of them is the best at his position in baseball. Tulo at shortstop, Donaldson at third, Bautista in right, Edwin is a DH, Martin is a catcher. And even if you said, well, no, I think there's better catchers than Martin, try to argue that they're not among the top three at their position. And they're the first five hitters in your lineup. So people think, oh, you guys are just doing commercials for the Blue Jays. Think about that for a minute. How many times can you say that about one ball club that has five guys? I know Martin usually hits six. You could run one to five in the order that are among the top three at their position, and I would suggest top two. I think those five guys, yeah, maybe Donaldson's not the best. Donaldson is the best third baseman, I think, right now. Well, maybe Tulo is not the best shortstop. Yeah, Machado's a great player. Yeah, exactly. That's
maybe,
right.
Maybe Machado. Maybe. Right? Yeah.
Maybe. And throw David Price in as your ace and starter. And where does he rank? Yes, there's Kershaw. Yes, there's other pitchers. But you see what I'm saying? How good these guys are?
Yeah, I mean, our Sportsnet Magazine's MLB preview way back when, we had the Jays slated as the top one through five hitters in the league, the most fearsome fivesome. That was before Tulowitzki arrived here. So I agree wholeheartedly that, you know, you're right. They do have top two or three talent at every single position, one through five in the lineup for sure. I mean, Josh Donaldson's, in my mind, he's an easy second place in MVP voting right now behind Mike Trout, and he's giving Trout a run for his money. I mean, and if the Angels don't make the playoffs, then he's the easy MVP choice for me.
Yeah, I mean, for me, as big as the David Price trade was, when that Tulowitzki trade happened, that was the jaw dropper for me, because they already had pretty good shortstop there. Not the best at his position in the game, but a pretty good shortstop, a leadoff hitter that I think a lot of people would have been happy going into the playoffs with. They traded for Troy Tulowitzki.
Classic Anthopoulos.
I mean, this
just
is
out of the blue.
Out of the blue. I mean, this is
what do you do in the offseason? Everyone said he needs a pitcher, he needs help in other positions, and he brings in Donaldson at third base. He already had Brett Laurie. And like, and then he brings in Martin as catcher. We already had Navarro. And now he brings in Tulowitzki, and we already had Reyes. Everyone's waiting for him to improve the other positions, and then he follows it up by getting David Price.
I mean, it's huge. It's it's really nice to see that after 22 years, but the past few years of building, drafting a lot of pitchers, building towards this. And even before the trade deadline, the question was, well, what do you do? What do you do with Daniel Norris? What do you do with these young pitchers? You don't want to trade too many of them away because then where's this team going to be next year? Who cares?
Yeah,
I mean, now is the time. It's always tomorrow, tomorrow, tomorrow with not just the Blue Jays, but every Toronto sports team. And now this is finally the time where the GM said, now we're going for it. We're going all in. We still have a few good prospects to come, but our best ones are gone. I don't care. I don't care if David Price leaves this offseason. I don't, it doesn't really matter. This is the team that's going for it. They have an historically deep and deadly lineup and a pitching staff that looks unbeatable right now.
Yeah, and look what it's done. I mean, it's, we're looking at sellouts, you know, and look what that does for the organization as well. I mean, every ticket that's sold, every beer that's sold, every hot dog that's sold, everybody, every pair of eyeballs on the television, anyone who's listed on this radio station or watching on the live tracker on sportsnet.ca, I mean, that's all money in the pocket, right? That's showing that a little bit of investment can lead to a lot of return. And it was refreshing to see that, like you said, Rory. And I think what it's done is it's, as we all know, it's created this frenzy around this team that's national. And I think it's also, there's been a long-suffering fan base of loyal fans in this city of Blue Jays fans who have been to a lot of like 13,000 people on a Thursday night at the Dome, or at the Rogers Center, sorry. And we're seeing there all those years of waiting, coming back, and now they're finally seeing what everybody's been hoping for. And I think it's been great for them to, you know, to reap the rewards of actually being real fans. And we're seeing now 45,000 of them, of a sophisticated fan base showing up for baseball games.
Yeah, here's another factor too, guys, when we talk about prospects. There's a difference in my mind between a prospect and a player. And really depends too on how young you're, because everyone said, leading up to the trade deadline, all I heard when I'm hosting shows on The Fan is, oh, they're never going to get Price because the first thing they're going to say is, okay, we want Stroman back and they're going to hang up the phone. Like, people talk like that. General managers don't talk like that, first of all. But the point being, well, Stroman is a kid. Osuna is 20, turning 21. Sanchez is a kid. Pompey, still forgot about him, is lighting it up in Buffalo. It's not like they don't have, yes, 11 pitchers out of your organization is a lot. Hoffman, there's some great prospects there. Daniel Norris, we all know they did give up value to bring these guys in. But it's not like some people, I read some American magazines right after the deadline saying, well, the Jays better make the playoffs this year. My answer to that is, well, they expect to make the playoffs, but why do they have to make it this year? Bautista and Edwin are under control. They have an option on Dickey. Burley is either, I don't think he's going to retire, but is able to get back. It's not like they got a bunch of 40-year-olds or they gutted everybody and they got all these old guys. Some of the core guys on this team are kids. And even Donaldson and Tulo, under contract, still in their prime. This is the difference between this team and a lot of other teams. And even, not, I don't want to keep comparing, 92-93 had Winfield, Molitor, like Jack Morris, guys who were just near the end of their careers. Who on that team, outside of Dickey and Burley, depending on what happens to them, is near the end of their career? Nobody. And they still have that core of Stroman, Osuna, Sanchez. So yes, they gave up a lot of young pitchers. And yeah, Price doesn't resign. I look at this team, why won't this team contend again next year?
Yeah,
even if they didn't have David Price.
For me, when it comes to making trades and dealing prospects, if they're not on your major league roster and performing up to standard, who cares? You know, I'd like to have Noah Syndergaard in our rotation instead of Drew Hutchison, but Noah Syndergaard is not pitching as well as R.A. Dickey right now, so I guess we win that one. I don't know. I mean,
and you don't get Tulo without Reyes.
Exactly.
And Reyes came in that deal.
Yep, exactly. So move the kids if you need to. I mean, if they had moved Stroman, Pompey, Sanchez, and Osuna at the deadline, then I would have been questioning it because those guys are proven major league performers. Well, Pompey, not so much, but the pitchers especially.
And those three young guys, Sanchez, Stroman, and Osuna, I mean, two or maybe three of them could end up in your starting rotation at some point in the future.
Yep.
I mean, I think this goes for most, if not all, prospects and maybe especially pitchers in baseball. You don't know what these guys are going to become. No matter what the scouting report says, no matter what the projections are, anything could happen to these guys. Something mental, something physical. And you see this all the time with young baseball pitchers, highly ranked guys, and their careers don't really pan out. They don't go anywhere for whatever reason. So that's why it's totally worth giving these guys up for a commodity that you know exactly what you're going to get out of that. Whether it's for 1 year, whether it's for the next 2 or 3 years, you're getting a quality baseball player to put a quality product on the field, something this city just has no idea about. It's been so long since we've had a winning team. And I think that's a huge reason why people are coming out too, is this whole feeling of actually having not a good team, a contending team, is a feeling that we haven't had in such a long time. It's everybody's buying into this.
Yeah. I mean, the Jays just released Joba Chamberlain, who was one of the top five prospects in baseball not too long ago, and was the Yankees' number one prospect, right? I mean, you know, and he had a career of sorts, and he definitely pitched in the majors, but would you have traded Joba Chamberlain 5 years ago for, or 6 years ago for a David Price-like guy at the top of your order?
John, I did whole shows on this station, entire shows on that the Blue Jays 4 or 5 years ago, whenever it was, the Blue Jays, no matter what, cannot trade Travis Snyder. We did whole shows on Travis Snyder, who was DFA'd by the Baltimore Orioles.
Yep.
Now, and I'm not, maybe Travis comes back. Please don't take that the wrong way, that I'm no, you know, piling up on the poor guy because his career's kind of, we did, honest to God, it was, you can't trade him. You can't trade Travis. He was Babe Ruth, Barry Bonds, A-Rod in his prime, all rolled into one. So you never do know. But it is exciting, and it seems like they have the best of both worlds with this. John Gregg, Rory Boylan, Roger Lejoie for Ben Ennis. Sportsnet Magazine live this weekend. Glad you're with us. All right, guys, we have to do now what we are noted for in the media. Nitpick and find something negative, because we have just been too good. So there are some, and it's not negative, but there's decisions to make. Marcus Stroman is one. What do you guys think about, how do you approach that, work him in? You got a good thing going here, but if he says, come on, I'm ready, what do you do?
Well, pitchers need, 4 weeks. Like, spring training is too long, but pitchers need 3 or 4 weeks to get stretched out as starters in spring training. And this is what this is for him. He needs time. You don't need to rush him back to throw an inning here or there in the bullpen, because really, where is he going to get in? I mean, not in the 7th, 8th, or 9th anymore. So you want to stretch him out, and then hopefully he comes back in late August, early September, and you can drop him into the rotation and see what happens. Get ready for, without jinxing it, get ready for playoffs and see how he stacks up with the other 4 or 5 guys.
And then it's, where does he slide into that rotation? If Hutchinson keeps pitching well, if he has a good outing against the Yankees on Sunday, where would you put Stroman? Maybe Hutchinson's going to start finding it here down the stretch. If he's going to find it, it's going to be right now. A, he's running out of time, and B, the whole team's rallying around everybody right now. If he finds it, now you have 5 pitchers who are pitching really well. Where do you slide Stroman in here? And you don't need to bring him back this year, other than, if we're going to get negative, maybe the pitching slows down. Is R.A. Dickey going to keep this up the rest of the year?
Somebody gets hurt. There's always something.
There's always something. So it would be nice to have Stroman ready to go in case an injury happens.
I think there's no doubt that he'll be ready to go, and that's the plan, is to stretch him out to make sure he can come up here and throw 5 innings at least when he first hits the mound, right?
Here's how things have changed, though, thanks to the trade deadline, guys. And, we talk about, as we should, Tulo and Price as being the guys. But you bring in LaTroy Hawkins and Lowe, and you add them to the bullpen. Now you sit back, and originally, before the trade deadline, you're thinking, well, if Stroman can pitch, get him in there, we can put him back in relief, if we need him back there. Now it's like, there's no innings for him to pitch.
There's no urgency to get him back, right?
You've got an 8 and a 9 guy right now in Sanchez Osuna. You've got Lowe and Hawkins, and we haven't even talked about guys like Brett Cecil and the guy in the bullpen who have been Cecil's got a great stretch going. Like, so seriously, when you look at it, it's either start or take your time, come back next year. And that just shows how deep and good this team has been as a result of the trade deadline. Because before the trade deadline, you're thinking, oh, get him in. You need him. And if he can start, great. If not, he can be in the bullpen. So now you either bring him back or you don't. And if you bring him back, he's starting, and you stretch him out. And if the problem is you got too many good pitchers, what a nice problem to have.
It's just amazing when you looked at this team a few weeks ago, a couple months ago, and the bullpen. What are you going to do with this bullpen? How are you going to add enough arms to kind of secure this? Because this is a big problem. And now you look at it, and you have Stroman, who's maybe your ace of the future, and you can't even fit him in there anymore. I mean, there's no room. And it's amazing how that bullpen has turned around into one of the maybe the bigger strengths on this
game. And you don't want to try and fit a, you know, a square peg into a round hole, right? I mean, the bullpen is performing well. The guys know what their roles are. Even have like Aaron Loop has thrown an inning and a third since January 20 or July 26. Like, he can't even get into games. So you don't want to be taking away innings from the Lowe's, the Hawkins, the Sanchez's, and Osuna's because you feel like you have to get Stroman in there just to see what he can do or to make sure he gets a chance to pitch, right? So don't worry about it. Bring him back when you can in September when rosters expand. Throw him out there for a Hutchinson start. See what he does. Maybe he's electric and who knows what happens. And if he's not, you're okay. You know, you've got spot starts. You can start him. You can start Hutchinson. You know, you can bring up Randy Wolf if you really need to. And you can find ways to make it work without having to force him into your lineup somewhere.
One of the topics before things really turned so great for this club was John Gibbons and his ability to manage. And early in the season, as there always is, he's not that great a manager. Now, of course, the team is on a roll. Now everything is great. I'm not even going to so much comment on John Gibbons' ability as a manager. I look at management, guys, is you need the right manager for the right team. You need veteran teams require a certain kind of manager. Younger teams require a certain kind of manager. John Gibbons, no matter how you feel about him as a manager, period, is best served here. He's not an interferer. He is a player's manager. He's a laid-back guy in the clubhouse. With this kind of talent, here's the most important thing I think John Gibbons, and he knows it better than I do, just don't mess it up. I think he's become a better manager for the Blue Jays as a result of these player acquisitions.
Oh, 100%. I mean, he's... Big league managers do two things, or have to do two things well, especially with good teams. Manage a bullpen and manage a clubhouse. And this clubhouse is decidedly different than it was at this time last year. And Gibbons, you're right, just has to step away, manage the personalities, make sure that he can get guys into the lineup to keep them happy. They understand their roles, but they're still getting their at-bats and they're still getting a chance to play in the field when necessary. And make sure that the bullpen's working well and that he's picking and choosing his spots correctly with those guys. Other than that, step away, don't say a word, and just let your players go out and perform. And I think that's what he's been doing pretty much all year. And let's not forget that for basically the entire first half of the season, he didn't have his A lineup because of injuries. So it wasn't his fault what was happening when this team was floundering. And I wouldn't say that it's his credit now that they're not floundering, but he's found that sweet spot and allowed his team to perform around it.
I think it was David Price who said he lets us be men, you know, away from the field. Like, he lets you be. The talent's going to take care of itself out on the field. Gibbons just needs to manage the bullpen in a way that he's not, you know, getting in the way, and he does that. But off the field, just let the guys be. Let them be relaxed. Let them do what they have to do to get ready for the game and be in the right mindset, and then he needs to go and make the right calls in the bullpen. But just this whole atmosphere around this team, led by John Gibbons, just that, okay, you guys can take care of yourself. We have the tools. We have the lineup. We have the skill. You guys know how to do it. Go out there and do it now. Hands off.
That's Rory Boylan, John Gregg. I'm Roger Lajoie at Sportsnet Magazine Live. Coming up, tough decisions still ahead for the Blue Jays in this upcoming offseason, obviously. David Price is a big-time free agent. They got to figure out what to do with him. But there's another free agent that we're going to talk about next, Alex Anthopoulos. What do you do about him? That's next on Sportsnet Magazine Live on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
With a taste of what's inside the current issue of Sportsnet Magazine, here's Jeff Blair.
You couldn't stop Rick Langford in the summer of 1980. For 2 months, the Oakland Athletics right-hander finished every game he started.
Rick, every time he went out, you figured we weren't going to use the bullpen. We knew the streak was on. He wasn't an overpowering guy, but he just had this great command, and he was a great competitor. Here he is painting everybody to death, and he just keeps piling up innings and complete games.
22 consecutive, a standard that will never be equaled given the age of bullpen specialization and the way young arms are now coddled. The game still doesn't know what to make of the way Billy Martin managed his young staff back then. Gilt-edged arms such as those of Langford, Mike Norris, Brian Kingman, Matt Keogh, and Steve McCaddy. It could have been a generational pitching staff, but with a weak bullpen and stubborn mindset, Martin rode his starters and turned a 100-loss team into a playoff contender in 2 seasons. They were like a comet passing through the majors. The transition into post-playing careers has not been smooth for all of them, but Langford has spent the better part of 20 years with the Toronto Blue Jays as a pitching coach, rehabilitation coordinator, and now a mentor, selected by the organization to work with hand-picked, fast-track pitching prospects. Rick Langford says his job is to get minor leaguers to the majors, not simply see them advance up the minor league ladder. He oversees the Blue Jays' version of finishing school. He has become the closer, and you can read about it in Sportsnet magazine.
This story and more appears in the latest edition of Sportsnet magazine, available on Next Issue and in the Apple Newsstand.
Alex is not motivated by money. Alex is motivated by challenges. Alex is motivated by the challenge of putting together winning teams. He likes Toronto. He is Canadian. He's a proud Canadian. He likes what he's doing. And, you know, all things being equal, you know, I think he's the type of person that would stick around here.
Paul Beeston on Primetime Sports talking about Alex Anthopoulos, general manager of the Toronto Blue Jays. It's Sportsnet Magazine Live. I'm Roger Lajoie, John Grigg, Rory Boylan in the house. As we continue to talk about the Blue Jays on this hot summer weekend, and boy, they are the talk of the town. Alex Anthopoulos is the talk of the town, too, for the moves he made. It's the no-brainer in most people's minds now, boys, that, yeah, you got to re-sign him, you got to bring him back. But all of a sudden, Alex doesn't have a contract next year, and I don't want to say all of a sudden, but I would imagine there are a lot of Major League Baseball teams that wouldn't mind having Alex Anthopoulos as their general manager.
Yeah, there might be 29. I mean, yeah, I don't see how Alex isn't back next year. I mean, I've been a detractor of his over the years because I've always thought that he didn't pull the trigger mid-season to make things happen for this team. Obviously, that's not the case this year. But when you look at the amount of patience he's had and the way he built up the organization to give himself an opportunity to do this, and the strings that he's pulled and the kind of ninja moves that he's made, whether it was the Marlins trade, the Dickey trade, or the Tulowitzki trade, or the Donaldson trade, I really feel like he is one of the premier GMs in this league who's run a great organization from, you know, the low minors right up to the major league team now. And I think it'd be a bad business decision on any newcomer to come in and let Alex walk.
Yeah, I mean, you've built up a lot of goodwill here, and it's because of Alex Anthopoulos.
Imagine
if
the hue and
let
cry,
him go.
Right?
Exactly. I mean, you'd still probably have a pretty good team entering next year, but that would take away a lot of this hype right now. If you lost Anthopoulos, we have this great team. This is the guy who built it, and now you're letting him go. I mean, where's the continuation here? How are we going to keep buying into this? This guy kept his three top pitchers and added two Cy Young Award winners and built an incredible lineup. It would be a no-brainer to me to sign this guy for 10 years right now. I mean, he's incredible.
No argument, but here's the thing, guys. Now it's a case of, and, you know, Beeston's clip made it quite clear that he says Alex isn't motivated by money. It's challenge. He's a Canadian. He likes Toronto. What he's basically saying is, like, it's gone from should we keep Alex to, oh, yeah, of course we're going to keep Alex. But now Alex has an option of saying, well, maybe there's a better opportunity for me. Especially the key is Beeston is leaving. So it doesn't matter what your walk of life is. And, John, you're a boss. You know this. Well, the rest of us who work for bosses know it. It's like it's about the person we work for. And if you bring in, and it's been largely speculated, Dave Dombrowski is not like a Lou Lamoriello who's 72 and president and, you know, we work with these younger guys. Dave Dombrowski sees himself as, well, I can run a baseball team and I did a great job in Detroit and I've got 25 years experience or whatever. How does a guy like Alex Anthopoulos think about that? I'm not saying Alex would consider leaving Toronto, but now he's got the option as a guy who doesn't have a contract to say, well, maybe there are better opportunities for him. Because let's face it, if they really loved Alex Anthopoulos as much as Beeston says they did, why didn't they re-up him? Why do you leave a general manager in the last year of his contract? What did we all say before the trade deadline? Alex's job is on the line. We yeah. all did. Everybody... It's on the line. He better do something this time. Now he's done it, and it's, yeah, okay, well, we'll bring you back. Well, hold on a second. Maybe there's other options out here for me.
Yeah, I think you're right. That it's now, I think Alex Anthopoulos wants to win a World Series. If, you know, if everybody's dreams come true this year, and the Jays go and win the World Series, and then they go out and hire a guy as president who wants to be more hands-on on the day-to-day and the player movement and personnel changes, then maybe Alex says, okay, find yourself a GM who wants to play nice. But I've won my World Series. I've proven I can build an organization up, and I'll go find a new challenge somewhere else. Like, it's all, everything's in Alex's corner now, because you couldn't. I don't think you could come in here and let him go. I'm looking at a poll online right now, 2,700 votes. Do you approve of the job Alex Anthopoulos is doing? 90% say yes.
What's wrong with the other 10?
Well, 7% are neutral. So I don't know why you even have a neutral in a poll. But anyway, like, everybody thinks he's doing a great job. It sounds like from the organization down, from the fan base up. So letting him go would just, I think it would be a PR nightmare. And I'm not sure you need a president of baseball operations to come in here and be hands-on.
But that's my point, guy, John. And that's my point. There's no question that they don't have to. But, of course, they have to really keep Alex in the fold. He's done everything requested of him. He's built this team. But then the flip side is, and I go back to the boss then. The boss is leaving. A new boss is coming in. And on the surface, before this, anyone would say, how could you say no to Dave Dombrowski? He's won a World Series in Florida. He built, one of the guys built the Expos. He, years in Detroit, been to two AL championships, been to two World Series. His track record is really second to none, and apparently there's some degree of interest. You can't do both. So if you don't bring Dombrowski in, then you still have to bring it. Like, Alex isn't going to hang around with Rogers president and you know, talk.
No, but you're not hiring a GM. You're hiring a president, right? So you don't need, like, all... Dave Dombrowski's a great GM. You're right. He's won World Series. He's done all these things. But as a GM, and you're not hiring for that position. You're hiring for president.
Well, then it's not Dombrowski in my mind. I think Dombrowski still wants to be a general manager.
I don't think you need that kind of president to come in and run the Blue Jays, which are an arm of a major corporation, not, you know, Mike Ilitch's plaything, right? Like, you need somebody who can go hang out with Rogers presidents and jet around the world and be more of a corporate type. You don't need a baseball man, especially because you've got one who's proven to be pretty damn good.
That's just it. You have your GM. You have a darn good GM, maybe the best in the game. You don't need to go and get another guy who's going to meddle with that. You get the guy who's not going to be hands-on. You have Anthopoulos to do that. And I think that's where the Jays are now. This is maybe the one time that you don't want the big ticket addition to this front office. Whereas, yeah, a year ago, you look at Dombrowski, like, yeah, of course we want this guy. We need somebody to come in here and get this thing going. Now the ship's righted. Everything's going perfectly. Now you don't want a guy to come in and meddle with that. You have your GM, take care of him, and then hire a president who's going to work with him and letting that president know exactly what the roles are here. Anthopoulos is in charge of baseball.
Yeah, I agree. I hope it works out that way. It just makes me nervous when I see Dombrowski's name being put in at this stage of the game. To me, Alex Anthopoulos is a general manager. Give him a fat contract, make sure he's really comfortable, and go find a Richard Petty type, a businessman who can help the business grow.
I think a baseball mind as president of the team is a nice thing to have. It's gravy right now, but it's not a necessity. I think the necessity is somebody to run the business side of the operation, because with the way things are going right now, there's going to be a whole lot more importance put on the business side of the operation, because there's more business to be done.
John Gregg, Rory Boylan, I'm Roger Lajoie for Ben Ennis, Sportsnet Magazine Live this weekend. Glad you're with us. Got a couple of minutes to talk about the other free agent. We don't know what he's going to do. David Price, obviously. It's too bad, too, you know, that we don't have a game show or something. The price is acceptable. The price is...
Price
average,
chopper.
The price is interesting. I wish I could come up with something, but the price for David Price is going to be astronomical. So whether it's Alex, whether it's the president, where that might be, whether it's the ownership, do you just open up the vault and give him what he wants? What do you do?
I would. I think this is, you don't come across guys like this very often. And you have to do everything that you can to try and keep him and keep this. Your window is open right now. And in any sport, those windows can close the snap of a finger. They can close way quicker than you think. They can stay open a little longer. And if they can keep David Price, it keeps that open. It keeps that window open a little wider for a little bit longer. Now, I don't know how realistic it is to keep David Price. At this point, I don't think it matters. But if the option's there, yeah, I absolutely go hard at him to keep him around.
The only way you get David Price to sign on the dotted line is if you waive your 5-year rule.
But that's the new president's call, isn't it?
That would be the new president's call, although it might also be Alex Anthopoulos is called because he might believe in it. You know, there's a budget to work within and all that, but if he feels that you don't want to sign an aging pitcher to a 10-year contract worth $300 million, that's fair. But that's what it's probably going to take, something in that range to be able to lock up David Price. And, you know, unless you really, really, you know, blow him out of the water with like a $40 million over times five offer, something like that, and make him the highest paid player in baseball by a wide margin, you're going to have to give up that 5-year rule. And, you know, I don't know if it's worth blowing your budget just to lock him up.
Well, budget is the question. Budget is a question. What's the payroll going to be on this team? At the start of the year, I think it was around $126 million, 9th or 10th in baseball, which is certainly respectable. I don't have the figures in front of me, but you re-sign Price, and because of the window, when Tulo and Donaldson under still good contracts, you have Bautista and EE, you'll have to deal with them at the end of 2016. But for next year, you take your payroll to $160 million. That's a lot. That's a big increase. I think he can run baseball for the next couple of years.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And the thing with Price and the rest of them is the best pitchers on this team outside of Price are young. So although it'd be nice to have him and to sign him on long term, if you think that Stroman and Sanchez are the real deal, well, then you start to run into a place where you don't have enough spots in your rotation for all the guys that you want. And then you go out and fill in the bottom end of it on the free agent market, right? It would be really nice. I don't think it's a necessity for the long-term success of this team to sign David Price long-term.
Will be fascinating to see for sure. The price is acceptable, large. I'll come up with something. John Grigg, Rory Boylan, I'm Roger Lajoie for Ben Ennis at Sportsnet Magazine Live. Coming up, the price of the Maple Leafs front office might be higher than the payroll of the team on the ice. Is that a good idea or a bad idea? We'll talk about that next on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
This ain't like when you're at a game and sign up for a credit card just to get the prize and then you immediately cancel the credit card. Because there's no prize when you sign up for our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand.
Yeah, I definitely feel like that's a good way to go and just another step in, you know, in the right direction. And I don't feel like I'm at my best or anywhere near it, but I feel like I'm going in the right direction and I want to keep that up.
She's not at her best, says Serena Williams, yet she has a chance at the calendar Grand Slam at the U.S. Open. Wow, can't wait to see her best. It's Sportsnet Magazine Live. For Ben Ennis, I'm Roger Lajoie. Great to be with you. John Grigg, Rory Boylan, with me here in studio. You talk about tough on yourself, guys. Holy smokes, John. Serena's not at her best. She's 40-1 this year. Are you kidding me?
I don't think she is even... You get the feeling she's not even playing against other players. She's only playing against herself. Her expectations are so high that even when she dominates opponents in, you know, the third round of a pretty major hardcore tournament, she is not happy. You know, she has 9 aces and she wants 10 or 11, right? She doesn't even realize how good she is because she can, like in terms of the stats, because she just doesn't quite feel 100% yet. And it really is an amazing thing to see an athlete dominate her sport like that. There's nobody doing that anywhere else in the world right now.
And that's how all the best are in any sport. They always have to push themselves. And with Serena, I mean, if your competition isn't pushing you, then you have to push you to keep you on the edge, or else you might get a little satisfied and dial back a little bit. With her, I mean, she is just blowing through the entire tour. You're right. She's playing against herself and she's being hard on herself to keep herself on top of her game.
Well, what's amazing about her, I guess, is when you look back at her career, early in her career, her and her sister Venus were criticized at times for not taking it seriously enough, maybe being too interested in the trappings of the tennis world. And as she's gotten older, when usually, you know, the skills start to step away, 32 is not ancient for tennis, but it's tougher. We're seeing it with Roger Federer. You could make a very strong argument now. She is more dominant and a better player at 32 than she was at 22. And she was pretty damn good at 22 as well. So I think what happened is the great physical skills that she's always had have now been matched by her mental toughness, because, John, she is just unstoppable. You're right. She only loses when she does something bad. It has nothing to do with her opponent anymore.
I'm not sure that you could make an argument against her being the most dominant athlete of her era, of this era. You'd be looking at guys like LeBron, Tiger Woods, Roger Federer during his heyday, but I'm not sure that she isn't leaps and bounds better than everybody else, you know, more than those guys were even at their peaks. Maybe Tiger, but otherwise, she's the most dominant athlete of the past 20 years, 15 years.
Yeah, maybe because it feels like it was so long ago, but you sometimes forget how dominant Tiger Woods was when he was at the top of his game, winning a major by 12 strokes. Yeah. I mean, that's unbelievable, but you... It's hard to argue against Serena, too, because she is still doing it, and she is not showing any signs of slowing down, where Tiger obviously has fallen off. But when he was at his peak, he was so far beyond anybody else on his tour. How long can Serena keep this going for? I think that's going to be the determining factor of who is the best. When it comes down to it, you can't go wrong picking either one of these two, but if she can keep this going on for another few years, then yeah, I think it becomes a no doubt that she's the one.
Yeah, it's a longevity aspect of it. I think Tiger's fall from grace really, it's unfortunate. Even if you don't like Tiger Woods, nobody likes the way things have worked out for him the last 5-6 years. But I think what it really illustrates, because then you take a look back at his career and you see his career Grand Slams, he had all those major titles before he was 34 years of age. Never mind winning by 12, which he did in Masters and dominating the field. But the next closest guy has 4. That's always the thing in individual sports, guys, and in team sports is too. But individual, how do you compare to everybody else? Everybody says it's amazing. And it was the same argument we heard in hockey when people talked about Wayne Gretzky and tried to say, well, it's a different era. Scoring is higher. And which was very true in Gretzky's day. He's got 1,000 more points than anybody who ever played hockey. So if it's that easy, how come nobody else did it? And that's my judgment. So back to Serena, Tiger. Well, yeah, he won a pile of majors. He was a great golfer. Or Serena's won all these majors. And yeah, but whatever. It's like, who's next? Who is number two in women's tennis to Serena Williams? And when Tiger was winning, who was number two? I don't know. Ernie Els,
David
Mike
Duvall,
Weir.
BJ Singh,
yeah,
Phil
seriously.
Nicholson.
It was,
right?
The gap was enormous.
Yeah. I mean, so, even if you look this year, I mean, she's got almost $9.2 million in singles earnings this year. The number two player behind her, Maria Sharapova, has almost three. Like, it's not even close, right? I mean, she just crushes everybody. She's won 85% of her career matches. Like, Tiger didn't win 85. I mean, obviously, he didn't win 85% of his of tournaments. I mean, he won a lot, but I don't know. I just, the numbers are just outstanding, and if you're a numbers person, I think it's hard to make the argument that she isn't the best player in any sport that we've seen in a long, long time.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. When she's got the record that she does, and she's got all the majors that she does, I mean, there's no conversation here on who is the best in women's tennis right now. It's just not even close. And you're exactly right. When you compare the best, you have to compare them to what they're doing against their competition in their era. What did Gretzky do in his era against his peers? What did Babe Ruth do against his peers in his era? And this is how it goes.
Example of Babe Ruth, year he hit 60 homers. The rest of baseball hit 150.
Exactly.
Like,
yeah.
Combined. Like, yeah. It was stupid.
Incredible.
It's like, it's like, so you're so, I guess the only thing is, and it's hard, you know, team sports, individual sports is different. I guess I was thinking about it, earlier on the drive in this morning, and I was thinking, Tiger Woods came. You mentioned Federer, because Federer was dominant too. My God, what a won everything in sight. Probably Usain Bolt, though. It sounds like a dumb analogy, but he's the kind of guy, when he was in the prime running, it was only him and the clock. There was nobody else. It was just a case of, and then there was even thought, and I don't know the guy, but people were saying he could actually probably go a little faster. But
he keeps slowing down at the end, right?
He's looking behind him.
He's pointing in the air. I mean, run through the tape, man.
And do the bull thing. Can you imagine if he was going all out, is the point of it. So she is remarkable.
I'll just say this. I got one more stat for the stats. But in career earnings on the WTA Tour, the gap between her and number two is larger than the amount of money that number two has won.
Okay, there you are.
So she's at like almost $73 million. She'll jump over that probably this weekend. Maria Sharapova at 35. So there's about a $37 million gap between them. I mean, it's just amazing to me.
Wayne Gretzky is the career NHL goal scoring leader of all time. Take away all his goals, and he's still the points leader.
Yeah.
That's exactly it. It really is incredible. John Grigg, Rory Boylan, Roger Lajoie for Ben Ennis, Sportsnet Magazine Live this weekend. Great to be with you, folks. Well, Serena Williams is terrific and is playing at the Rogers Cup and is trying to win another championship, and the Canadians are all gone, and they were all gone early. It has been a disappointing cup of a Rogers Cup for the Canadians. John, what do we read into this performance this week from Jeannie Milosz? Well, Vasek at least won a match, but it was not a good week for Canada.
Yeah, I mean, there are some people who would say that it's a crisis for Canadian tennis. There are others who would say, well, Jeannie's having a down year. Obviously, Milosz has been hurt, and do you really expect Pospisil to go much further in tournaments than second round? And, you know, for me, it's about a lack of depth. It's about some real disappointment for Jeannie Bouchard. I don't remember the last time an athlete fell this far. I think she's something like 4-15 this year and hasn't beaten anybody outside the top 36 in the world. I mean, and she's losing to players who are ranked 120th and worse in the world. So she's not even looking like a top 36 player. And Milosz, the U.S. Open is coming up, and that'll be a big tournament for him. And coming back from injury, I don't think you could have expected much.
Yeah, it's a disappointment. It's not a crisis. It's a disappointment. It's growing pains. You know, this program is starting to take off. It's not there yet. These players, for the most part, are still pretty young, especially Jeannie Bouchard. And you have to hope with her. She's 21 years old. I mean, that's really young. You got to hope that, and you got to think that there's a lot of time for her to get back on track. To get her head back in it, to find her game. She's got a new coach now. You got to figure there's a lot of time, but you're right with Raonic. There's a big tournament coming up here at the U.S. Open, and then again coming back next year when hopefully these injury concerns are behind him. It's time for him to make a serious move, whereas Bouchard probably has a little bit more time to figure out her game, although she can't keep going on doing what she's doing like this forever. Yeah, that's hard to get out of.
And there are a lot of good juniors coming up out of the Tennis Academy in Montreal. And, you know, it's a big step from the junior tours and loops into the pro ranks. But, you know, they're there. I mean, you see Canadians who are winning junior majors or junior grand slams all the time. So there is a program in place for Canadian tennis, and there is some talent. It's just that the top end players right now are just not performing as well as everyone would hope.
I would agree. And I think you got to take, you know, guys, look at the three individuals. I mean, listen, Canada has done better and better as the years have gone on in the Davis Cup and the improvement. John, you make a good point about it's not just Jeannie Milosz and Vasek. There are a lot of good young players coming up the Canadian pipeline. So I think Canadian tennis is in good place. I expect a lot from Vasek, to tell you the truth, though. I kind of see him as a guy who might be ready for a breakthrough. I think he's disappointed when he does not make it past the second round. So we'll see where he goes. And I think his career is certainly developing. And now a good sign is he's no longer concentrating on doubles. He's going to make singles his priority because he knows I've got a chance to be a great player. So I feel good about him. Jeannie, I don't even know what to say anymore. I think we're all out of words as to what's happened. This is like a full calendar year. If you go back to last Wimbledon, the day and night change from year to year is phenomenal. Clearly, it's mental. There might have been a little bit of smoke and mirrors in the first place. You know, she had a good draw at Wimbledon that year. There were a few other things, but I mean, she was a Wimbledon junior champion. It's shocking. In fact, you know, the tennis commentators that during the Wimbledon final, I remember watching that saying, there's the future of tennis right there. Jeannie Bouchard, she's the future of women's tennis. And it has not worked out, which is difficult. And Milosz, I don't know what to think of Milosz. You know, the injury factor this year has hurt him without question, but it depends on what you're expecting. Now, so you're not expecting much maybe from a Vasek, but Milosz Raonic, I really thought, had a heck of a chance to be a top three player who, you know, wins 5-6 majors in his career. I think he's still a great player and has a chance to be a very good player. I don't know if he's going to be that good, though.
He's grown up against a tough era.
No question.
there are four guys in the world right now who are all better than everybody else, and there's no arguing that point. But I mean, is Milos Raonic a one-trick pony? You know, is he a big server who maybe can't get around the court as well as you need to and doesn't have the finesse shots that you need to compete with Federer and Djokovic and Murray and Nadal? I mean, all those guys are all-time talents for sure. Maybe not Murray, but the other three are all-time talents, and Milos Raonic just isn't. That's an argument. We'll see. If the excuses come to an end with injuries and whatnot, we'll see what he can become. But right now, he's just a guy who's won five or six small tournaments around the world and hasn't done anything else of any real note in any tournaments that the three of us sitting around this table right now would even know, right? I mean, we only look at like Wimbledon and Rogers Cup and other Grand Slams, and he hasn't done much in any of those. And that's where you make your name in this sport.
And that's where the conversation's at with Raonic right now, and that's why it's different to look at him and Bouchard. They're in different situations. They're at different points in their career. Whereas Bouchard has a little longer, Raonic, we're going to find out very soon what this guy really is as a professional tennis player in the next year or so. And if he doesn't start winning meaningful tournaments, if he doesn't start making, you know, runs, deep runs, and maybe even winning a major here very shortly, then maybe he won't reach the expectations we've had for him. But his time to make a move is coming up here really quickly.
You can make the argument that Jeannie Bouchard, despite all her troubles this year, has had a more successful career than Milos Raonic. I mean, she's made semifinals at Grand Slam events. She was called the number one most marketable woman in the world in terms of sports figures. I mean,
how much of that is a reflection, though, back to your point about how difficult it is on the women's side as opposed to the men's? Now, with Serena is the number one, but it's a lot easier to get through and work your way through. It's never easy. I'm not going to diminish going to a Wimbledon final. But, you know, vis-a-vis, if you want to move up in the rankings, a lot easier for a woman player than it is a men player in this era.
Yep, I agree. I mean, it's the field is not as deep on the women's side at the top end as it is on the men's side. But, you know, getting on national television, being known around the world, that helps. And that she is the flag bearer for Canadian tennis. It's just that the flag is kind of at half mast right now.
Oh, good line. That's John Gregg, Rory Boylan. I'm Roger Lajoie for Ben Ennis. And you're listening to Sportsnet Magazine Live. The Toronto Maple Leafs have made some off-season news, and that's probably pretty good because in-season their news is never good or hasn't been for the last decade. Of course, Babcock was the story earlier in the summer, and they continue to surprise us, bringing in Lou Lamoriello. And although Jacques Lemaire's announcement of him being an assistant coach is not of the magnitude of a Babcock or a Lou Lamoriello, gentlemen, there isn't much question that the Leafs front office looks a lot different now than it did in the days of Richard Petty and John Ferguson Jr.
Yeah, I think, Brendan Shanahan is building something in Toronto that could quickly become the envy of a lot of organizations around hockey. You can never have too many good minds expressing their opinions. And it doesn't mean you have to come to a consensus to make your decisions, whatever they are, whether it's who the coach is, who the players are going to be, or who's in management. But to have different viewpoints coming from different generations, even, I think is a great thing. And when the summer started, if you said that the Leafs were going to have guys like Mike Babcock, Lou Lamoriello, and Jacques Lemaire in the fold, I think everybody would be happy. I don't think anybody can complain about that, and I think they're all proven hockey minds who are just adding to what is becoming quite a robust front office and coaching staff.
Yeah, and I think, you know, first of all, it's another just great hire, but whether you're talking about these experienced guys who are here to make player acquisitions or the guys who are here to coach, I think something that's underrated, an underrated challenge when you're going through a rebuild is getting out of that losing cycle. It's one thing to go into a rebuild and to draft these guys really high and build a good prospect base, and it's a whole other thing to get out of the losing. It's really hard to change that losing culture into a winning culture, and you're seeing that in Edmonton. Obviously, this team has been down there for years now, and they have a lot of good high-end talent, but they haven't been able to get out of that rut yet, and it's harder to do that, I think, than you think. It's not just a matter of bottoming out, picking two or three guys at the top of the draft and then moving on up to the top of the standings.
It's
coaching. No, it's not the NBA. It's coaching. It's management. It's developing a culture. a system, and you have to start at the bottom where the Leafs are right now, and it's going to take a little bit of time. Although if they keep adding these guys, these coaches, they might get a little bit more out of these teams than you think, than they would under lesser coaches. If you bring in these guys, they might get some more out of these groups than you'd expect.
It's hard not to like them. The names are significant. Hey, listen, there's Hockey Hall of Famers, for heaven's sakes, in Lou Lamoriello and Jacques Lemaire, and Babcock's won a couple of gold medals and a Stanley Cup, and it's all good, and Brendan Shanahan, and on and on and on. But can you have too many people there? That's the only, I guess, concern I have. I look at it, you know, Mark Hunter and Kyle Dubas are young, aggressive, really smart managers working their way up. If everybody's happy with their role, I don't think it's an issue at all. I was talking to you guys off air about the way the Red Wings used to do business and still do business. But, you know, you'd get a conference call to talk about hockey matters, and you'd have Scotty Bowman and Steve Yzerman and Ken Holland and Jimmy Devolano and Mark Howe, and you know, Hockey Hall of Famers and their scouts from Sweden. So I guess you can never have too many people there if everybody is happy accepting their role. And that's the only thing I think about all this. But listen, who doesn't like Jacques Lemaire and who doesn't like Lou Lamoriello?
Yeah, I mean, for me, I don't think it matters what your business is, whether you're running a hockey team or a radio station or a magazine or a website or whatever, a Fortune 500 company. It's about ideas. And the idea that you can have all these minds, you know, working together and bouncing ideas off each other. I mean, who knows what you come up with, or who knows what rock you turn over and find somebody in Europe or whatnot. So I don't think you can have, if you have too many cooks in the kitchen, that's one thing. But just having people knowing their roles, being happy with their roles, and having a lot of people taking care of a lot of different roles, I don't see any issue with that, as long as everybody's respectful and they have, you know, opinions that are respected by the other people in the room.
And I think there's some old school guys in this management group and on the coaching staff that you think, well, maybe they're going to be behind the curve. But I think what it is that you're seeing with Dubas and Hunter, these older guys are going to come in and say, okay, here's how we've done things, and we've won a lot in our careers. And then at some point here in the near future, they're going to hand this off. Who's going to be surprised if Kyle Dubas is the GM in a few years? You know, these guys are going to be running the show soon. And again, this is a long-term project for the Leafs. And when it comes to coaching, you know, you look at the Marlies too. They're developing players and coaches down there. It's a whole organization rebuild that they're doing. And I don't think it can hurt to have too many of these guys, because everybody who's from the younger generation is going to learn something and take this forward with and build the organization with. And these older guys are here to sort of set the standard, set the culture, and then the rest of the organization can move forward with that from here.
Mike Babcock was quite clear at his introductory press conference that there's going to be a lot of pain. This is going to be a process. It's going to take a while. And I think mostly fans, the intelligent ones in the crowd and people in the media, say, well, it's about time they decided to do it properly. But with this kind of talent in the front office, coaching, player development, all the positive things, does this not run the risk that this team is maybe, quote unquote, too good? We saw Edmonton and Buffalo do it in the Connor McDavid sweepstakes. And it's not the same thing, deliberately losing games. Any team that deliberately loses hockey games is going nowhere. It doesn't matter what you're doing eventually, because if you're throwing games, that nobody throws a game. But to set yourself up like Buffalo did, you got a goaltender who made 30 saves, get rid of him because he's too good. You're losing. The Leafs' problem for a lot of years was that they were ninth, 10th, don't get the high pick. And we saw that treadmill going back and forth. Do they not run the risk with the talent they've got in management? And the fact is, let's not forget, guys, the day Randy Carlyle was fired, the Toronto Maple Leafs were in eighth place in the Eastern Conference. So does this team run the risk of being, quote unquote, too good?
Yeah, I think 100%. I think Leafs fans have embraced the idea of a rebuild, and you rebuild through the draft, and Mike Babcock is not going to suffer losing. He's not going to suffer a lack of discipline on the ice. He's not going to suffer a lack of physical fitness on the ice. He's going to have a system in place and expect everybody to play into it, and if you don't, you won't be playing. And he has proven that he can take depleted lineups and make them much better than they should be. So we might be staring ninth in the face and not getting that kind of high draft pick that everybody hopes for, and not getting the fourth overall pick for a second year in a row.
And that might not be the worst thing in the world. If you have all these managers, all these guys with experience, maybe they're more likely to pick up the right guy at number 8 in the draft or number 9 in the draft or pick the right guy, sign the right guy to Europe or make these smaller moves that start to add up over time. And, oh, now we have all these assets. Now maybe we can make a trade. That's exactly what the Buffalo Sabres did. They had all these assets that they could finally start moving, and they got a little bit more aggressive. And now you're looking at that team, and they got a pretty darn good forward unit. The defense could maybe use a little work. But they have moved forward, and maybe that's the end goal here with this team is you don't have to finish last in the league, and you don't have to get that guy. If you move forward, they don't have a bad prospect base now. And if you move forward and you send the right message through coaching, you make the good small moves from management, and then you end up with assets, and that's what you move forward with, whether in trade or you develop these guys, and maybe you get to where you're going quicker than the Oilers.
Well, that's the hope for sure. And I guess if you look at it too, the Oilers have not succeeded. Chicago did to a certain extent, got a little lucky with the lottery balls. Everyone says, how long is it going to take? I guess as long as it need be. Sometimes you can expedite the process. Sometimes you can do it 3 or 4 years. Your point, though, about finding somebody at the lower picks, that's how the Red Wings did it for so long. They were a dominant team in the National Hockey League, and still are in some cases, really, for 20 years without having a top 5 pick in 20. I don't think they had a top 10 pick. In 20 years, but they'd find a Lidstrom, they'd find a Datsyuk, they'd find a Zetterberg. If this scouting department can do it, it's easier if you're handed a Connor McDavid. But on the other hand, if you can find players close to a McDavid further in the draft, I guess maybe that's the hope.
It's about quantity too, right? I mean, it's about hoarding assets and then seeing what they become. So, I mean, even the signings this summer of, you know, guys like Sean Matthias and P. Parenteau, I mean, that's about seeing, hopefully, they're on show me 1 year deals, and then hopefully you trade them for second round or maybe even first round picks as part of a package later on. It's like the Santorellis and Cody Franzens of this season, and then then you pick your guys and you wait on them for 3 years and see what happens. And that's the model now, slowly but surely. And you hope that you strike it rich, like you say, Roger, with finding some diamonds in the rough.
And Shanahan has talked about this where he said, we need more players. And that's what he's talking about, is getting players who you can develop or players who other teams are interested in acquiring. And you build out your base, because where they started from, it was very, very thin. And you build out this base by acquiring these players that Shanahan is talking about, acquiring draft picks in trades for P.A. Parenteau or somebody later on in the season, and building an organization. That's what this is all about, is rebuilding an organization. And I think that's why it's great to have Lamoriello and Lemaire come in. These guys have done it with the Devils, and that was, for the longest time, the gold standard organization. Them, or the Detroit Red Wings, where Babcock has come from, those were the gold standard organizations, and I think that's what Toronto is doing here, building the organization from the bottom out.
Rory Boylan, John Gregg, I'm Roger Lajoie for Ben Ennis, Sportsnet Magazine Live. Great you're with us this weekend. Well, it's easier if you have a number one overall pick, and I don't want to put any more pressure on Austin Matthews than there already is, because you have those consensus number ones. Connor McDavid went through it. John Tavares went through it. Angelo Esposito went through it. And some people might be saying, who the heck is Angelo Esposito? He was a consensus number one pick before his draft year. Didn't work out in his final year of junior, slipped to 15th or 16th. So you never know. But this kid is interesting, John, because his decision, instead of going, what's the decision? CHL or NCAA, now play in Europe before you're drafted. It's pretty interesting.
I find it to be a fascinating test case, and I think a lot of people around hockey are going to find it to be that too. Here's a kid who comes from a non-traditional market. He's born and raised and played all his hockey in Scottsdale, Arizona. Didn't grow up feeling like, you know, dreaming of playing for the Oshawa Generals or the Kamloops Blazers or anybody like that. Obviously isn't interested in spending a year in the NCAA. So instead he goes over to Europe to play for a former NHL coach and Mark Crawford, to play against men, to test himself against physically mature players on a big sheet of ice where you have to skate, and to see what that does for his development. And for me, I find it interesting as well, because what does it mean for the CHL or the NCAA? Those two entities have been battling for players pretty fiercely, especially over the past kind of 5 to 10 years. If you throw Europe into the mix for top-end players who have the skill and the size to play against men in Europe, what does that mean for the more traditional feeder leagues? I don't know, but it would have been a shame if we didn't see Connor McDavid skating for the Erie Otters last year, or John Tavares before that, or Steven Stamkos before that.
Yeah, I mean, it's so interesting to see what is going to happen here. How much ice time does he get? How good is he against these men? I would think that he would probably be pretty good, but sometimes, you know, European prospects who come through sometimes play against men in those leagues, and they don't light up the league, but it's a good experience for them because they play against big men, and that's a huge difference from playing against junior. And that's another reason why the NCAA for some players can be better, because you are playing against, they're not fully grown men like they are in these European pro leagues, 22. But they're early 20s, you know, they're more physically mature than the 18, 19-year-olds you're facing the CHL. But this is a whole new ball game for North American prospects. I'm not convinced it's going to change drastically the whole process, because, you know, a lot of these leagues have limits on how many North American players they can have on their rosters, and they're not development leagues. They are trying to win. But if you can bring in an Austin Matthews, a number one overall pick, that's a draw that they would probably be interested in. So maybe it changes it a little bit for guys like that, but first we have to see exactly how this plays out, how he does, how much ice time he gets, and any other potential problems that come up.
Well, yeah, whether this becomes a trend or not will be correlated to how well the kid does. If he goes there, lights it up, comes to the NHL more ready to play, great. If he struggles there, or even if he does well there, yet finds life difficult when he gets to the NHL, the test case always is how everybody else is going to act. I can tell you one thing, as a guy that's been around, and I've worked, as you guys know, for the CHL in addition to covering as a broadcaster, and it just shows you my background. My first thought, where's he going to school? Where's his education? Because we get that from parents all the time. We're hammered as, well, hey, you don't care about the education. Where's he going to school if he's going to play hockey in Europe when he's 18?
Well, I don't think Austin Matthews cares very much about school.
That's the whole point.
And maybe I'm not saying that that is a good attitude to have. It's no different than spending 1 year playing college and then going to the NHL. This is a kid who is an exception to the rule. He might have gone number two last year over Jack Eichel, and Jack Eichel played in the World Championships and looked pretty good playing against full-grown men. And if Austin Matthews is that good or maybe better, it might be a wasted year for him to play against college players, or play even worse against junior players and just dominate people his own age or a couple years older again. I mean, he's been doing it his whole life. So I don't think he's going to ruin himself or his development by going to Europe. And it might actually serve him very, very well. And that's why I think it's an interesting experiment.
His numbers with the U.S. Development team were on par with Phil Kessel and Patrick Kane, and maybe even better.
He was setting records for that team.
Yeah, so this guy is clearly, you know, above the talent level that he's been playing against. This is going to be a whole new, different, bigger challenge for him. But again, it might not be the move for everybody, too. If Austin Matthews isn't, you know, concerned about his education right now, I don't think that goes for many other players, maybe. Maybe some guys don't want to be too far away from home. It's a culture shock. You're going halfway around the world to play. That's not going to be for everybody either.
I wish him well, but I really got a lot of alarm bells. If it was my son, I would pick the CHL or the NCAA, a little bit too uncertain, especially a consensus pick. It will be fascinating to see that story play itself out, though, that's for sure. John Grigg, Rory Boylan, I'm Roger Lajoie. More to come. You're listening to Sportsnet Magazine Live on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
With a taste of what's inside the current issue of Sportsnet Magazine, here's Gare Joyce.
302 players were selected in the Ontario Hockey League draft this spring. 301 of them had played more ice hockey than the kid who went number one overall. It's just about the strangest story that you're going to come across this season. Sudbury picked David Levin first overall this spring. The top line of his resume is nothing out of the ordinary. Last season, Levin led the Don Mills Flyers to the provincial championship game. Typical stuff for a top pick in the OHL draft. But if you went more than 3 years back, you wouldn't see any line of stats. He wasn't on the ice at all. Levin has a good explanation for that. Fact is, David Levin grew up playing roller hockey. Inline hockey is what some call it. His hometown of Netanya in Israel didn't have a rink. The nearest ice was 4 hours away, so Levin had skated only a couple of times every season as a kid. 3 years ago, he left his parents in Israel and moved in with his aunt and uncle in North Toronto. A lot of kids dream of playing AAA hockey. Levin stepped right into AAA, and he was a playmaking wizard before he even knew how to stop on skates. David Levin's story is one you'll have to read twice to believe.
Story and more can be found in the latest issue of Sportsnet Magazine. Available on Next Issue or by downloading the Sportsnet Magazine app for Apple, Android, and Windows tablets and phones.
Sportsnet Magazine Live. I'm Roger Lajoie. Rory Boylan, John Grigg with me. This weekend, as we continue to talk about what has been an intriguing time in sports. What you want if you're a league, guys, is a quiet offseason, I would think. Eh? After, if you're in the NHL, the Stanley Cup is presented, everybody feels good, and then you have shots of guys with the cup on a boat, and they're playing in their backyards, and it's all good. You don't want to, you're just, if you're the PR department, you're just going, please, you know, nothing bad happened, and let's just get to the season, and then we can kind of deal with this.
No Twitter.
Yeah, exactly. Please. Yeah, no picks. Please, no, guys, no, leave it alone. From Patrick Kane to Mike Richard to Jarrett Stoll, it has not been a great offseason for the NHL, has it?
Not really, but I mean, I don't know. Like, these are just guys, you know, they're young millionaires, it's younger than myself. I know what I'd be doing if I was their age and a millionaire. I mean, I'm not saying I'd be doing exactly what they're doing, but I'd be having a good time. And I don't think you can fault. I mean, when it comes to criminality, that's a different story. That's a whole different story. But in terms of having a good time and maybe good times get out of control a little bit, I don't think you can fault those guys for it. And I mean, they're not role models, right? I mean, they're athletes. I mean,
well, that's the question, though, isn't it? Should they be? Should we expect more from them on a personal level? Because they are, especially in team sports. I'm going to stay away from individuals, but a guy in a team sport, do you have a problem with a guy who represents a Toronto sports team going out and acting like a whatever?
I have a problem if he goes out and breaks the law or hurts somebody. I don't have a problem if he goes out and enjoys himself in Muskoka over the summer. I mean, yes, probably the best athletes are role models, but role models are parents and teachers. You know, I got a little buddy right now, Holden. He's at home. I know he's listening. His role models are his parents and his teachers. They shouldn't be the players that he cheers for, because you don't know those people. They're basically strangers, and you don't know what they're going to do. So if you want to go out and have a good time in Muskoka, go do it, but don't expect them to be perfect. Just hope that they're good.
And that's it. Choose your role models wisely. I mean, these guys live a life that we simply can't relate to. They're young, they have money, they have fame. It's not anything that I can relate to myself. The role models out there that you're talking about, parents, teachers, I mean, these are people everybody can relate with, and that's why they're more realistic role models, I think, and that's the difference here. These are, like we were talking off air, these are entertainers. These aren't role models. Maybe a select few of them are good role models, but I think this is a reminder to pick those role models carefully. These guys are athletes, they're entertainers, and they live a life that we just cannot relate to.
Well, you talked about the word entertainer, and that's the way I feel about this, guys. And yeah, listen, criminal stuff, awful, terrible. Throw the book at them. I agree with that. I think everyone, hopefully everybody on the planet feels that way. But I look at a professional athlete in the same way as I do a movie star or an entertainer or a musician. I enjoy their work. I like their movies. I like their music. And if they happen to be like, oh, yeah, and they were drunk the other day and they were partying and all that, that's not my problem. I don't think anybody should ever have a role model in life. Doesn't matter how old you are. If somebody you've never met and you've not even had a conversation of, and even then, how much do we really know people? So you're right. Your young friend, anybody is right. The role models are your parents, the people close to you. But the expectation that athletes are going to be a little bit better is one. And Charles Barkley was the one that said it, like, you know, and was dead honest about it years ago. And he was right. It's like, I'm nobody's role model. I'm not pretending to be anybody's role model.
I don't see why anybody would look to athletes to be any different than any other part of the population. They're just people, just like the rest of us. They make mistakes. They do good things. It's a hodgepodge. they struggle with in their lives with personal issues just like anybody else. They struggle professionally just like anybody else, despite the money that and fame that comes with it. Everybody makes mistakes. And when it comes to people getting in the news for having too good a time, that's part of their job, right? Is that they are in the public sphere. I've had too many good times, or I've had good times that have been maybe too good. I just, nobody knows about them because I'm not a professional athlete.
Rory, you should really get on that, get that stuff out on Twitter.
And you know, speaking of Twitter, you know, in this age with social media, everything gets noticed, everything gets analyzed and sometimes blown out of proportion. I think back to Evander Kane's money phone shot from a couple of years ago. That was a guy enjoying his wealth, enjoying his time in Vegas, and it turned into this huge thing. Like, look at this guy showing off what he's done. But this is a young guy, and again, this is something none of us can relate to. He's not doing anything criminal. He's not doing anything wrong. He's enjoying his life that he's got there. He's having a good time. There's nothing wrong with that.
If I had that kind of money, I might send out the exact same
exactly.
photo.
Exactly, exactly.
Right? If I could be Tyler Seguin, you know, 15, if I was 15 years younger and had a yacht full of chicks like Tyler Seguin, I would probably tweet that as well, because wouldn't that be fun and cool? I don't see the problem with it.
Let's take it from this standpoint then, and let's just use the team sports, because individual sports, golf, tennis, you know, you guys go off the rails from time to time, and the league, if you can call golf and tennis a league, the people that run the sport have to make decisions on punishment, but that's individuals, that's different, because they don't really belong to anybody outside of their hometown. But the NFL, the NHL, MLB, you're the PR person who usually gets the information first. You got to put the spin on it. Then you're the front office. We've seen it in the NFL. You have situations, whether it's Ray Rice, whether it's Tom Brady, talk about totally opposite things, domestic violence and deflating footballs or whatever. Do you think the leagues are doing a good job? And you're the National Hockey League, and you're looking at Kane and Stoll, and then Richards, and that's not a legal thing, but it's a contract thing. When you got a mess like that, are these leagues doing a good enough job in your mind, guys, to discipline and try to control this the best they can? Given what we just said, well, the role models, they shouldn't be, kids shouldn't have them as role models anyway. But if you're a league, surely you got to do something, especially, as you mentioned, John, when it goes against the law. Do you like what the NFL and the NHL does in these things?
I think it's a very difficult position that those leagues are put in, because everybody's innocent until proven guilty. And you can't jump the gun and come down hard on somebody and hammer them until you know they've done something wrong. And with all the information that gets out there now in the media, with 24/7 sports going on and social media, everybody likes to jump to a hot take and declare their opinion without necessarily knowing all the facts. And that's where the leagues, although they might look like they're dithering, they're really just waiting for the final result to come down before they can make their decision.
And that's all fine and good. That's how it should be. But when the decision does come down, when they are found guilty, if they did something criminal, the league has to come down hard.
But they rarely do.
I agree. It's a problem.
It is a problem. When you look at what Tom Brady got for Deflategate, how ridiculous that was. I mean, you can't compare something criminal to something like that and have the suspensions be somewhat similar. You have to go above and beyond.
Being allowed to be around the LA Kings this year. I mean, that's a perfect example of a league that they made a mistake on that one, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, by not acting quickly and decisively enough beforehand. You're right. And the role model stuff and the legalities, guys, are one thing. There's no question. When you get into legal problem, the leagues have to do a better job doing. Joe, we're just about out of time. I guess, John, you'll be going to party somewhere, apparently, because you've really tipped it off. I mean, your boss, I tell you, this guy's really just going to be, just keep your Twitter off.
I'm not okay? Rory's boss. I'd like to say that right now.
Rory Boylan, John Gregg, gentlemen, a pleasure to be with you on Sportsnet Magazine Live. Thanks so much, fellas.
Thanks, Rog.
I'm Roger Lajoie for Ben Ennis. Thanks to our technical director, Alex Machinsky, our producer, Mark Boffo, and thank you for listening, everybody. Have a great weekend from all of us right here on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.